Reading number one. French-British contact.
Life on the frontier was difficult for the first Europeans who migrated to North America. In New France, many of the traditions of the seigneurial system they had known in France were modified and adapted for North American conditions. The distinctions between the local aristocracy and the peasant were not as sharply drawn as they were in France at the time. The seigneur in New France had neither the wealth nor the prestige of his counterpart in France. Many seigneurs had to work in the fields alongside the habitants, who were willing to accept a limited form of the seigneurial structure of France, but refused to accept any extension of the feudal system in New France. By the mid-18th century, the society of New France had become more paternalistic than it was authoritarian. The great difference between France and New France was the wilderness. Just a mile or two down any river was a life of adventure, wealth, and freedom for any lower-class person who had the initiative to dip his paddle into one of those rivers. The coureurs de bois, the fur traders, became the romantic heroes of the Society of New France. Those who felt restricted by feudalism could find freedom and money at the same time, and those who were successful in the fur trade gained far more status than official leaders such as the seigneur. The fur trade became a major industry, and although it was considered too shady and too free and easy by the elite, they never ignored its profitability. By the 1750s, the people of New France had created a vast trading system and a huge empire. However, their empire was short-lived. After years of battles against the French, the Indians, and some of the 13 colonies, Britain committed more than 50,000 troops to the conquest of New France. Once the conquest was completed, Britain and the colonies found themselves with a different set of problems. The fundamental issues were, how should the French Empire in North America be carved up, and who should control it? People in the 13 colonies were adamant that the land should go to them. They saw their future in the Ohio Valley and lands west of the Appalachian Mountains. Land speculators, including George Washington, had spent a great deal of time assembling land in the Ohio Valley, and they did not intend to allow it to remain in the control of Quebec. Indian peoples were aggressively asserting their claims to the land, and were creating alliances among Indian nations to give themselves the power to halt the European invasion of their lands. Finally, there was the issue of governing a colony that was made up of 65,000 French-speaking Canadians who were Catholic and had different political and economic institutions. At the time of the British conquest in 1759, the French had been living along the St. Lawrence River for 150 years. They continued to be influenced greatly by the church, and they lived in a hierarchical, feudalistic society. After the conquest, some French colonists returned to France, but most remained in Quebec, even though they faced risks as a conquered people. Their main interest was in continuing their lives in the New World. They would be satisfied if the church and the Western fur trade were allowed to continue. Three British governors of Quebec, Murray, Carleton, and Haldimand, came to like the paternalistic authoritarian society that had been created in New France. When it came time to recommend and implement policy for the governing of the colony of Quebec, these men sympathized with the point of view of the Quebec elite. Several British business people moved from the British Isles and the 13 colonies to Quebec after the conquest, and they sought to secure a monopoly in the Montreal fur trade. They found it profitable to adopt the fur trade infrastructure and the knowledge and contacts of the coureurs de bois. Everyone in Quebec continued to support the notion that furs and their profits should move down the St. Lawrence River on their way to Europe. Few, if any, supported the use of either Hudson Bay or the Hudson River for transporting furs. After the conquest, the British had two problems from a political point of view. The first problem they faced was that, under British law, they could not recognize the rights of Catholics. In Britain, the king was the defender of the faith and could not be seen to be under the control of the Pope in any way. When the Bishop of Quebec died in 1760, and only the Pope could appoint a new bishop, Britain was placed in the position of having to break its own law to satisfy the rights of French-speaking Canadians. The second problem was that British merchants in Quebec were quarreling with British governors. The merchants wanted an elected assembly and other rights they believed they were entitled to as British citizens. British leaders and the Quebec elite were very reluctant to put such rights in place in Quebec. British leaders, who were concerned about becoming involved in a long and expensive Indian war, leaned towards the Quebec point of view, which was that the fur trade monopoly remain in place, that the Ohio country remain part of the Quebec colony, and that the status quo be retained in Quebec. Relations between the 13 colonies and Britain were deteriorating rapidly, and the British government did not want to increase the power of the 13 colonies by giving them more territory. The British were also concerned that if war broke out between the 13 colonies and Britain, Britain would need a secure military base from which to operate in North America. This need resulted in the Quebec Act of 1774. This is but some of the background to historic decisions made by the British King in 1763 and 1774. Some of the terms of these decisions, the Royal Proclamation and the Quebec Act, remain an issue for Canadians to resolve over 200 years later.
Reading number 2. Social and political change in the Canadian Northwest.
Archaeological evidence indicates that Aboriginal peoples have lived on the Northwestern Plains for at least 10,000 years. They shared the plains with millions of buffalo, which supported their way of life. In the 18th and 19th centuries, contact between Aboriginal peoples and fur traders resulted in the development of another people, the Métis. Métis people were the descendants of unions between French and British fur traders and Aboriginal people. They created a new culture by selecting from their parents' cultures ways that worked best in the Northwest. The Métis built a successful way of life based on the buffalo hunt and on the fur trade. By the second half of the 19th century, the European frontier was encroaching more and more on the Northwest. Whiskey traders and buffalo hunters were among the first to arrive after the fur traders. The presence of whiskey posts such as Fort Whoopup and tragedies like the Cypress Hills Massacre outraged public opinion in central Canada. The government created the Northwest Mounted Police, who were able to restore order and gain the respect of Aboriginal and European people. However, life in the Northwest was about to change significantly. In the 1860s, buffalo herds were so large that visitors reported that it often took days for a single herd to pass by a location. But then the commercial buffalo hunt began. Though it did not seem possible to kill every buffalo on the plains, hunters killed thousands in a day, often taking only the hides, humps, or tongues, and leaving the rest to be scavenged. The city that is now Regina was originally known as Pile of Bones because of a huge pile of buffalo bones that were found there. By the last decades of the 19th century, the buffalo was virtually extinct. Only a few isolated areas contained the sparse remainder of the great herds. Euro-Canadians believed that the land was now empty and ready to be settled by farmers. The suitability of the Western Plains for agriculture had been debated throughout the 19th century. Some explorers saw the plains as a desert wasteland, while others argued that there was great potential in the Western Plains. By the latter part of the century, consensus was that the Western Plains of Canada were the last best West and a basis for turning Canada into a great world power. All that was needed were thousands of the right kind of immigrants. The government and the Canadian Pacific Railway mounted a massive advertising campaign. The West was portrayed as a budding utopia with beautiful landscapes, rich farmland, and a benign climate. Settlers would be able to build prosperous farms for themselves and their children to enjoy. The advertising was aimed mainly at people of Anglo-Saxon stock who, it was believed, would have the capacity to extend the virtues of British civilization into this beautiful wilderness. But the settlers did not come in the numbers needed to fill the land. Those who did come were badly prepared and bitterly disappointed at the hardship, privation, and loneliness they had to endure. The West was a harsh land, not at all what the advertising had promised, and only those who were willing to spend a lifetime in dedicated toil would achieve success. Some estimates say that half of the settlers left the plains prior to 1896 to find other, less strenuous and frustrating ways to make a living. Immigration to the West became a crisis. The new Liberal government of Wilfrid Laurier appointed Clifford Sifton to the task of finding successful immigrants. Improved economic conditions, the scarcity of arable land in the United States, and Sifton's aggressive recruitment strategies finally paid dividends after 1900. Europeans of diverse backgrounds sought greener pastures in the last best West. Within two decades, Western Canada became a polyglot, a mixture and confusion of many different languages, a multicultural society that would eventually demand cultural recognition. But at the time, federal and provincial governments were determined to assimilate these people into the dominant Anglo-Saxon culture of Canada.
Reading number 3. Our government, its origins and characteristics.
Governance is the act, process, or power of governing. In other words, government. Why is the system of government that we have in Canada today modeled largely on that of the British parliamentary system? If one remembers that Britain acquired New France in 1763, it would seem natural that the British would have introduced their system into the colonies of British North America at that time. Later, when these colonies joined together in 1867 to form the Dominion of Canada, it seemed logical that the government of Canada should follow the traditional system of government that the colonies had been using for more than a century. Also, during the American Revolution in the late 18th century, there had been a large number of people who abandoned the 13 colonies when these British colonies decided to revolt against British rule and constitute themselves into an independent republic, the United States. These people, who remained loyal to Great Britain, migrated north to the remaining British North American colonies. These United Empire Loyalists, as they were called, were staunchly anti-republican. That is, they wanted to retain their ties with Britain and the British monarchy. It is not difficult to understand, then, why the Canadian government that came into being in 1867 with the birth of Canada was largely modeled on the parliamentary system of Britain. Having looked at why Canadian government is based on the British parliamentary tradition, let's look at some of the features that Canada's government and Britain's government have in common. First, both are constitutional monarchies. the legal head of state for both countries is the King or Queen of Britain. He or she is not a monarch with absolute powers. Indeed, the monarch's power to rule has been limited through custom, convention, and tradition. The considerable powers once held by the kings and queens of Britain have dwindled to what now are largely ceremonial powers. Nevertheless, the British monarch is Canada's legal head of state, the legal head of the central government in Ottawa and of the provincial and territorial governments across the country. Second, both Britain and Canada have what is called a bicameral legislature. Bi means two, and camera means chamber. Thus, two chambers. Canada and Britain have two legislative bodies, an upper and lower body, which together constitute what we call Parliament. In both countries, the lower chamber is made up of representatives elected by the people of the country. The lower chamber is called the House of Commons. The upper house is smaller in numbers and has traditionally enjoyed less power than the House of Commons. In Britain, the upper house is the House of Lords, while in Canada, it is called the Senate. In both countries, members are appointed. In Canada, senators must now retire at age 75, while in Britain, appointed members of the House of Lords hold their positions for life. A third feature of both the British and Canadian systems of government is the principle of responsible government. Over many years, a practice developed whereby the monarch, or the representatives of the monarch, called on or asked certain members of one or both legislative bodies to form the government of the day, which came to be called the cabinet. This cabinet was usually presided over by a leader who became known as the first or prime minister. The practice evolved whereby the monarch chose as prime minister the leader of the political party with the support of the largest number of members elected to the lower house. From this group of elected representatives from the governing party is drawn a branch of government called the executive branch. The executive usually consists of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, who are charged with carrying out or executing the laws passed in Parliament. Parliament as a whole is known as the legislative branch of government. In the British and Canadian systems of government, the executive and the legislative branches are very intertwined. Not only is the executive branch drawn from the party with the largest number of members in the lower house, but the Prime Minister and his or her ministers, the Cabinet, introduce virtually all important legislation that eventually becomes law. In this sense, the executive branch has a very important and powerful role to play in the legislative branch because it usually dominates the legislative branch of government. When we speak about the principle of responsible government, we are saying that the government of the day is responsible to the legislative branch and must enjoy the support of the majority in the House of Commons. If it loses this support and is defeated on an important piece of legislation, a bill, then by custom it must resign and a new election must be called. The government is said to have lost the confidence of the representatives of the people. The fourth common feature of the Canadian and British governmental systems is the concept of representative democracy. In countries such as Canada, which have a relatively large population spread across a large geographic area, it would be impossible for people to participate directly in government. Instead, the people of Canada elect representatives from constituencies across the country to represent them in Parliament and to help govern. The sovereignty of the people, which is the power of the people in a democracy to control the government, in this case to elect the government, is exercised indirectly. In the ancient city-state of Athens, where democracy began, it was possible for citizens to travel from all parts of the small city-state to Athens in order to exercise their democratic rights directly. Because this is not possible in modern-day democracies, Canadians participate by vote in a representative democracy. This is yet another feature of government that Canada shares with Britain. There are, however, some differences between Canada's system and that of the British. First, Canada has what is called a federal system of government, which means that there are two main levels of government. Canada has a central government that serves the entire country. The central or federal government is based in Ottawa. Canada also has provincial governments which serve the interests of the people of the various provinces. On the other hand, Britain has a unitary system, one level of government centered in London. In a federal system, each of the levels of government has responsibilities for certain activities and has specific powers within its jurisdiction. When the representatives of the British North American colonies met in 1867 to draft a written constitution for the Dominion of Canada, it was their intention to give greater power to Ottawa and to strictly limit by defining and assigning the more local powers to the provinces. To ensure that Ottawa would remain a strong central government, the Constitution stated that any powers not explicitly assigned to the provinces would fall into the jurisdiction of the federal government. These powers are called residual powers. A second difference between Canada and Britain is that a considerable part of Canada's constitution is written. Britain's constitution is virtually a completely undocumented series of rules which have evolved over many years through convention, custom, and usage. A constitution is the rules and laws that determine what a government can and cannot do. It is the rules and laws that must be abided by in a political system. Not all of Canada's constitution is written, and the written conventions and traditions have evolved over time. For example, nowhere in Canada's written constitution is there any mention of the office of Prime Minister. The constitution uses the phrase, the Governor General in Council, as if the Governor General is a person with total executive power. In theory, the Governor General, as the representative of the monarch in Canada, has a great deal of power. But in reality, these powers, like those of the monarch in Britain, have been reduced to the point where his or her role is largely ceremonial. The real political head of government is not the Governor General, but is the Prime Minister. And yet the office of the Prime Minister receives no mention whatsoever in the written constitution. The British North America Act was the British Parliamentary Act that brought Canada into existence in 1867. This act was renamed the Constitution Act of 1867 when Canada took control of its constitution in 1982. But the Constitution Act of 1982 is, in essence, the BNA Act with its amendments. The Constitution Act of 1982, however, contains something that the British Constitution does not have, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This charter is a Bill of Rights which is enshrined as an integral part of the written constitution. It defines very clearly in writing the fundamental rights and freedoms of every Canadian citizen. Another difference between Canada and the British governmental systems has been mentioned before. Canada has the offices of Governor General for Canada and Lieutenant Governors for the provinces. Because the monarch does not reside in Canada, these offices represent the head of state. They exercise the powers and perform the duties for a monarch who lives abroad. One final difference of note between the governmental system of Britain and that of Canada is the judicial review of legislation that occurs only in Canada. Because Canada has a federal system with a division of powers between the provinces and Ottawa, and because Canada has a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the courts can review any legislation passed at any level of government to ensure that it conforms to the Constitution. If any law does not conform, it can be struck down or declared invalid, unconstitutional, by the courts. On the other hand, Britain has parliamentary sovereignty. In Britain, there is no division of powers between two levels of government, and there is no written Charter of Rights and Freedoms to be reviewed. In Britain, Parliament is the highest court of the land, whereas in Canada, the judicial branch of government may review legislation and find it to be unconstitutional. Thus ends a brief look at, or should one say, listen to, the similarities and differences between the parliamentary system of government which was adopted by Canada in 1867 and the parliamentary system of government which developed in Britain.
Reading number 4. Acculturation models and their impact on government policies toward minority groups in Canada. The cultural annihilation model.
Some Canadians believe that all Canadians should adhere to their vision of Canada. They dislike the ambiguity and compromise that acculturation demands and favor solutions they can rationalize as efficient for their version of civilization. These people may consider the physical destruction of certain cultural groups or the destruction of certain cultures as appropriate ways to preserve and extend their own particular culture. Warfare creates conditions which can be used to justify cultural annihilation. Military force, and in some circumstances, disease, have been used to decimate certain groups of people. Genocide against Aboriginal peoples in North America was attempted by the British during their wars with the French and various Indian nations in the 18th century. During the settlement of the American West in the late 19th century, many Americans advocated genocide as the solution to the Indian problem. For example, the American government hired Indian and Métis hunters to help slaughter the buffalo herds, knowing that when this food supply was depleted, native people would be dependent on the government and thus easily manipulated. In Canada, Protestant Ontario's anger at the Métis over the execution of an Orangeman, Thomas Scott, in 1870, turned to outrage against the whiskey traders after the Cypress Hills Massacre and led to the formation of the Northwest Mounted Police. A mere 15 years later, Orangemen from Ontario joined General Middleton's expedition against Louis Riel and the Métis to settle the score for Scott's death. Canadian attitudes toward the Indian nations and the Métis people shifted from outrage about Cypress Hills to anger and revenge after the Northwest Resistance of 1885. In the 19th century, justification for cultural annihilation or genocide was usually based on notions of racial superiority and inferiority. An often used rationalization was that the mixing of cultural groups or races leads to the decay of the superior group or race. After 1885, Canadians commonly accepted that they had a mission to civilize the Northwest. This belief was in accord with the Victorian worldview that European civilization was superior and had a duty to remake the world in its image. From this prevailing 19th century ideology, cultural annihilation of the Aboriginal people was rationalized as a kind of self-defense.
The cultural segregation model.
Canadian history contains a number of examples of the use of segregation as a way of dealing with problems of acculturation. It was first used by the British in 1755 when they relocated Acadians to English-speaking colonies far from their adopted home in Atlantic Canada. The most systematic example of segregation in Canada was the creation of the reserve system. This form of segregation was justified by the belief that the Aboriginal peoples could best be controlled by placing them together on small areas of land and by limiting their freedom of movement by the use of a pass system. To travel outside of reserve lands, native people required appropriate authorization, which had to be signed by an agent from the Department of Indian Affairs. After 1885, regulations became particularly stringent. The reserve system was justified also as a place of protection, where the interests of the Aboriginal peoples could be watched over by the state. But the program was often perverted by unscrupulous government agents and politicians who seized Indian lands for their personal enrichment. To many Canadians, Aboriginal people were seen as a burden on the taxpayer and possibly as a threat to the economic well-being of other Canadians. As a social model, segregation is usually rationalized on the basis of the cultural superiority of the dominant culture. The dominant culture believed it had a responsibility to protect civilization and to help the lesser culture learn about civilization. This, they believed, could best be accomplished by placing cultural groups on reserves in order to protect them. In reality, many of the so-called lesser cultures were complex, well-developed cultures that did not need protection. In some cases, cultural segregation is more or less voluntary. Hutterites, some Mennonite groups, Dukhobors, and some other immigrant groups chose to settle and live in discrete communities. People often prefer to live with others who share the same language, traditions, and customs. People are also sensitive to the rejection inherent in discrimination and prejudice. So people who are subject to discrimination often react by withdrawing in order to protect themselves.
The cultural assimilation model.
Assimilationists believed that inferior cultures should be stripped of their traditions, rituals, and beliefs, usually through some kind of educative process. They believe assimilation is necessary because society, if it is to function effectively, has to have a fairly high degree of conformity. Political unity and economic development, they believe, can only be achieved in a homogeneous society. There are many examples of the assimilation model of acculturation found in Canadian history. A fairly early example is Lord Durham's report in 1839, in which he argued that the best thing that could happen to the French Canadian was to be assimilated into the English Canadian culture. Naturally, French Canadians were outraged and were more determined than ever to protect their culture. Many immigrants came to Canada with the absolute intention of assimilating into what they earnestly believed would be a better way of life. Their fondest wish was to educate their children well enough so that they could enter middle-class Canadian society. The public school system was seen by Canadians as a major vehicle of assimilation. Its social role was to create good Canadian citizens. Therefore, the mission of schools was to acculturate its students into accepting the beliefs, values, and traditions of the dominant culture. The problem in Canada was, what was the dominant culture to be? The issue of cultural control of education came up repeatedly in Canada. The Manitoba schools question, a key issue in the federal election of 1896, revolved around the issue of whether Francophone Catholic parents could have separate schools in which to educate their children in their culture. Assimilationists argued that there should be only one school system, which would educate everyone to be English-speaking Canadians. Historians generally agree that this issue and the forced conscription of soldiers in 1917 were instrumental in breaking the bond French-Canadian people felt with Confederation. About the same time, historically, a decision was made to establish boarding schools for Aboriginal children. In these schools, children would live away from their parents' influence and be given a good Eurocentric education. It was believed that within a generation, Aboriginal culture would disappear and be replaced with Aboriginal Canadian citizens. The program proved to be highly destructive to both Aboriginal children and to Aboriginal culture. Family life is critical to the development of children, and many Aboriginal children were left with huge gaps in their emotional lives. Forced assimilation has left much bitterness among French Canadian and Aboriginal peoples of Canada. For many Quebecois, assimilation has been a clear signal that Canadians are not interested in a cultural partnership, and therefore they see their only future in separation from Canada and in political independence. Many Aboriginal people have reached similar conclusions and are advocating some form of sovereignty that would protect the Aboriginal way of life.
The cultural accommodation model.
Accommodation is the least elitist and authoritarian of the acculturation models. Its supporters assume that cultures which have survived and evolved over long periods of time have developed many positive features worthy of respect. People who support the accommodation model believe that in order for a culture to be alive, it must evolve and change. Rich and vibrant cultures are open to new ideas and new experiences that expand opportunities and potential for their people. Canada, despite its disposition to segregation and assimilation, has been willing to accommodate many different cultures. Canadian society has opened its doors to many different ethnic groups, and Canadian society has become richer for that act. Canadians often worry about the fact that there are so many hyphenated Canadians, such as Ukrainian Canadian or German Canadian. These are examples of the accommodation process at work. Accommodation is a creative process that happens when immigrants and their descendants fuse their culture with other cultures in Canada to create something that is at the same time old, new, and unique. Even groups such as the Hutterite people, who have chosen to remain segregated, have accommodated very well to the most up-to-date farming methods and have created a distinctive, successful approach to agriculture. An important part of culture is diet. The Canadian culinary experience is diverse and varied. If the Canadian diet were limited to that which comes from its British roots, it would be much more narrow and bland. Much the same can be said about customs, music, and ideas. The Canadian cultural experience is wide, diverse, and rich because of the many diverse cultures that are accommodated in Canadian society. The accommodation model has been the base for formal government policies as well. For example, the bilingual policy, which developed into the Official Languages Act, was implemented because of the belief that Canadians should be given the opportunity to use more than one language. Since the late 1960s, many different language acquisition programs have been developed so that Canadians can pass on their heritage languages to their children. Provincial and local policies have dealt with issues of religious rituals in public school settings. One irony of accommodation is that it often accomplishes more assimilation in the long run than does an explicit assimilation model. Aboriginal and immigrant cultures have proven they are very able to celebrate and accommodate their cultures within the context of a larger Canadian culture. Canadian culture must and will change. Canadians of British background are not the same as the English, Welsh, Scottish, or Irish people who remained in their homelands. The culture, language, and customs have all changed. New Zealanders, Australians, Americans, and Canadians of British background have developed and continue to develop different cultures based on common traditions. This process will continue. A century from now, these cultures will have changed from what they are today, just as they have changed from what they were in the past.
Reading number 5. The Staples Model of Canadian Economic Development.
The main motive of 15th and 16th century European voyages of exploration to North America was the search for the Northwest Passage to the riches of the Orient. Although this passage was not found, the Grand Banks off the coast of Newfoundland were discovered by John Cabot in 1497, and codfish became the first important staple commodity found in North America. Both English and French fishers made landings on the shores of Newfoundland to dry their catch before returning to Europe. This short-term stay provided little economic diversity until their contact with Aboriginal peoples led to a simple trade of necessities that eventually evolved into the fur trade. When discussing cod in the context of Canada's early economic history, we refer to it as a staple, Economists use the word staple to define any primary product that has come directly from the natural resources of the land or the sea and has received little processing. Much of Canada's economic history has involved the export of various staples as relatively unprocessed commodities. As Europeans began to move inland in North America, they recognized the importance of another staple, the beaver pelt. The English built trading posts along the mouths of the rivers which drained into the Hudson Bay, while the French built their posts along the St. Lawrence Great Lakes river system. Both were interested in securing the beaver pelt to be shipped back to Europe to be processed into men's beaver felt hats. As it had with the cod fishery, Canada was again serving as a colonial hinterland for a primary resource, while the value-added processing of the staple into an end product took place in the heartland of Western Europe. As the fur trade declined in the early 19th century, timber began to fill the void. The Napoleonic Wars in Europe had cut off Britain's traditional sources of timber supply, the Baltic region of Northern Europe. Canadian timber was demanded for the British shipbuilding industry. Although timber was also surface exploitation, it had the potential to allow for somewhat more domestic growth and development than had the fur. Initially, the only value-added processing of this staple was the squaring of logs into timbers. Later, with the development of a sawn lumber industry, more fixed capital investments were required to support sawmills in the colonies. Other spin-offs occurred. Land clearing for settlement, construction of canals and railroads, and the growth of lumber towns such as Ottawa and St. John. These were followed by an expansion of allied industries such as furniture making, construction, and shipbuilding. These spin-offs illustrate how the timber trade resulted in more permanent economic development for the home, that is, Canadian economy, than had the earlier staples of cod and fur. The development of the wheat economy provided even more stimulus to the Canadian economy. By its very nature, wheat production required permanent settlement. Economic spin-offs became more numerous. Farm populations demanded goods and services of all kinds. Food, clothing, shelter, transportation, farm implements, and education, to name but a few. Indeed, John A. Macdonald's national policy of 1879, with its provisions for a transcontinental railroad and protective tariffs, became viable with the development of the wheat economy in the West. The 20th century has seen the appearance of a variety of new staples, including base metals, wood pulp, petroleum, and more recently, potash and uranium. So, what are the similarities of these modern staples to the earlier staples of fish, fur, and timber? Although still resource-centered, these new staples are much more capital-intensive. That means they require much more financial investment. Some people would contend that although they have produced economic growth, these new staples have not led to sufficient development of value-added processing or secondary industries, that is, to economic diversification. These people argue that Canada is still mainly an exporter of unprocessed or semi-processed commodities, albeit to countries such as the United States and Japan rather than to Europe, while remaining an importer of many processed end goods made from Canadian staples. Let's look at forestry as an example of Canada's limited processing of primary products into end products. In a recent year, Canada produced 16% of the world's supply of wood pulp, but only 4% of the total fine paper and paperboard. Wood pulp requires less processing and thus commands a lower price than an end product such as fine paper. According to a recent study, Canada exported just 26% of its resources in a fully processed form, whereas Sweden, a country with similar dependence on resources, exported 57% of its resources in a highly processed form. The benefits to Canada of exporting more resources in a highly processed form are more jobs and higher profits. Production of basic resources does not require a lot of labor. It is later in the production cycle that the labor component becomes larger. By exporting relatively unprocessed products, Canada is foregoing profits that come from value-added processing of resources, particularly the big returns that can result from the development of new products. Another problem Canadians have faced with the Staples model was the boom or bust economy over which they had little control. For a time, demand for a resource would be high. The resource price would rise and create prosperity, a boom. This boom triggered increased production, which along with high prices would lower demand. Soon the market would be glutted and prices would fall, leaving resource producers bankrupt or unemployed, the bust phase of the cycle. Canadians have faced cycles of prosperity followed by depression, bankruptcies, and unemployment when the market for a resource has disappeared. This cycle repeated itself throughout Canadian history. The fish market, the beaver pelt market, the timber market, the agricultural commodities market, and the metal ores market. Finally, some people would point to the fact that many of Canada's newer staple industries are predominantly or wholly foreign-owned, and that this branch plant economy operates to serve the interests of the primarily American-owned parent companies, rather than to serve Canadian interests.
Reading number 6. Early trade patterns and the national policy.
In a previous discussion of Canada's economic history, we described how early European explorers bumped into Canada while searching for a shorter route to the riches of China. Even though China was what they were looking for and Canada is what they found, these explorers did discover things of great value. They found the staples of the codfish, beaver fur, and later timber and wheat. These staples were sent to Europe to be processed and made into final goods. The beaver fur, for example, was a classic staple in that the furs were gathered in Canada, mainly through trade contact between European and native peoples, and the pelts were shipped to France or Britain to be processed into a final good, men's beaver felt hats. The prevailing belief or philosophy of the time was that the colonies, whether they be in North America, Africa, or elsewhere, existed to serve the interests of the mother country. Therefore, commodities or staples were harvested and gathered in the hinterland and sent, mainly unprocessed, to the European heartland. You should be familiar with the 18th century struggle between France and Britain for much of North America that was known as the Seven Years' War. As a result of the peace treaty that ended that conflict, the area of North America that had been New France became part of the British Empire. As part of Britain's vast empire, British North America enjoyed preferential trading privileges with Britain and with other countries of the empire. In the early days, these privileges helped Canada because it gave Canadian products preferential treatment in a large world market. Canada's early trade was mainly with Europe and was mostly in natural resources. This pattern of trade continued into the mid-1800s when Canada was suddenly denied preferential trade privileges because Britain adopted a free trade policy. As a result, Canadian trade shifted direction towards the United States. Trade with the U.S. in the 1800s was based on the Reciprocity Treaty, which allowed for the free flow of goods between the two countries. The rapidly growing U.S. market was a key target for Canadian exporters. In 1866, however, the U.S. abandoned the Reciprocity Treaty with Canada and established tariffs to protect U.S. producers from Canadian competition. This was another serious blow to Canada. Another major world market was suddenly more difficult to access, not because of the free trade, but because of tariffs. Around 1873, a general worldwide recession or economic slump began. Canadian producers were dealt yet another hardship. They had already lost preferential treatment with Britain and free trade with the United States. Now Canadian exporters were hurt further by recession. It was in this economic climate that Sir John A. Macdonald and his Conservative government introduced the National Policy in 1879. The National Policy is generally considered to have three main components. The first was a protective tariff of about 18% on all foreign goods. A tariff is a tax levied on foreign goods to make these goods more expensive and make home-produced, in this case Canadian goods, more attractive to the domestic consumer. The result of this tariff was that foreign companies were shut out of the Canadian domestic market. How did foreign, mainly American producers, respond to these tariffs? Many foreign business firms jumped over the tariff wall by establishing branch plants in Canada. If they couldn't export their goods to Canada, why not establish branches of their businesses in Canada where they could produce the goods on Canadian soil and not have to contend with tariffs? Many of the industries that grew up behind the tariff wall were not so much Canadian industries as they were industries owned and controlled by foreign companies, most of which were either American or British. Because these plants were in Canada, the goods they produced did not have tariffs applied to them, and as a result, their goods were cheaper than foreign goods. The second component of the national policy was a nation-building initiative designed to attract a large number of immigrants into Western Canada. The idea was to bring in new Canadians to fill up the West and preempt any American plans to occupy this region. Also, this Western Canadian population would become producers of a staple product, wheat, which would generate much export income. And the Western Canadian population would serve as a market for goods manufactured in Central Canada. The third component of the national policy was the Transcontinental Railway, which was built with subsidies from the federal government and which became known as the CPR, the Canadian Pacific Railway. The idea was to have a railway to carry new immigrants to the West, to carry raw materials from the West to industrial Central Canada, and to transport manufactured goods from Central Canada to the Western Canadian market. A national railway, the government believed, would help to forge the East-West link, tie the country together, and solidify Confederation. As we look at the national policy, we can see another application of the heartland-hinterland concept that we discussed when we looked at the earliest staples. There had been a shift from a heartland in Europe and a hinterland in Canada to a heartland in the industrialized region of Central Canada and a hinterland in the Western Canada. Perhaps we should ask ourselves, does this heartland-hinterland concept that emerged with the national policy form the basis of later Western discontent with policies that appear to be made in Central Canada by Central Canadian politicians and seemingly for the benefit of Central Canada?